Well, as Andy announced, we are just a week away from our fall gospel meeting. Doesn't feel quite like fall out there, does it? But it is our fall gospel meeting, and Brother Barry Hudson, as announced, will be with us from Claremont. And you'll really enjoy Barry and Cerise. Cerise will be with him every evening. They're kind of the old-fashioned couple. They do things together. And sometimes we have gospel preachers from the area that they're just not able to bring their wife every evening. And she may work during the day or have other responsibilities. But they're a throwback to the old style. They'll both be together. She's always at his right hand. And she's a great, great gal. And that you will enjoy getting to know both of them. You know I have a special connection with Barry, if you don't know that. We went to school together many years ago, and he was the dorm monitor in my dorm, and so he checked every night to make sure I was in bed my second year in college, and so we go back a long ways, but he's a terrific guy, and he's an excellent Bible student, and you will enjoy getting to know them. And you will enjoy his lessons, and you will benefit. And so pick up some flyers back there on the back. We still have flyers. We printed some more this week. You've taken several of them. We encourage you to hand those out. We encourage you to read my bulletin article today to encourage you to think about the meeting and pray about the meeting and invite others. If you haven't read that, I challenge you to read that and ask you to read that bulletin article. It's an encouragement to invite others, to be praying about the meeting, to be doing what we can, to come each and every night ourselves, to sit up closer to the front and to fill in the middle. I have a couple of challenges there for you. And so please, please read that and be here. I know you will. I'm not having to tell this crowd that. You'll be here. But bring someone with you if you can. Encourage others. Give others a call. Encourage them because we have a feast that is waiting for us. On our Wednesday evening Bible study, we were talking this last Wednesday evening about Psalm 51. And David's psalm there, as he had committed a terrible sin with Bathsheba, and he had compounded that by trying to cover it up. And when that failed, he compounded it even more by giving orders to his general Joab to have Uriah killed in battle. He thought, I suppose, he had covered it up. Nathan the prophet visited him and said, "Thou art the man." And David truly repented. As I believe we said in class, there's something about David we certainly can see and we can understand. He made some big mistakes in his life, and this was one of them. He made another later when he numbered the people, numbered the nation. And so he made some mistakes, but there was one thing about David. He had a heart for God. Down deep, he had a heart for God, and we can see that. He was called a man after God's own heart. And we see in Psalm 51 his great sorrow, his true repentance towards God, as he begged God to forgive him of his sins and of his transgressions, the evil that he had done. Now, in the midst of that psalm, as we see David's repentance on that occasion, and I'm flipping back to Psalm 51, since I forgot to open it as we started tonight. But in the midst of that psalm, David says something that often we didn't have time to talk about it in class, but Psalm 51:5, after David says, "Have mercy upon me, O God, according to your loving kindness," after he says, "Wash me thoroughly from mine iniquity and cleanse me from my sin," after he says, "Against thee, thee only have I sinned and done that which is evil in thy sight," verse 4. He says in verse 5, "Behold, I was brought forth in iniquity, and in sin did my mother conceive me." It is a verse that is often used by the advocates of inherited total depravity to teach that we are born in sin. that David says, I was brought forth in iniquity, and in sin did my mother conceive me. And so it is often taught that David, see, it says right here, David was born a sinner. He was, from the time of his birth, he was guilty of sin. And so this is one of the main passages that's used by the advocates of inherited total depravity. And so since we didn't have time to get to that on Wednesday evening, I thought I would talk a little bit about this tonight. We're going to be getting to this verse in a little bit, but let's talk about the background a little bit and talk about inherited total depravity, what that means, and what that means in the theological idea of Calvinism. And so I have several quotes I'm going to read to you. They're going to be on the screen in front of you. If you have never studied this subject before, please just bear with me. We will hit the highlights. But I have several quotes I want to show to you. I don't want to just talk about it myself, but I want to give you the quotes from those who believe the doctrine themselves, so you'll see what they say about it. And then we'll talk about some of the passages that they use. Calvinism. Calvinism and Tulip. John Calvin was one of the big three reformers, we say. John Calvin, 1509 to 1564, was one of the big three of the Protestant Reformation. I've made reference already earlier this year to the fact that this is the 500th anniversary, we might say, of the Protestant Reformation. Luther, Martin Luther, nailed his 95 theses on the doors of a church in Wittenberg, Germany, 500 years ago this year. Luther and a man named Zwingli and Calvin were, I suppose, the three biggest names of that period as far as the Reformation was concerned. Calvin was what we might call a systematizer. Now, PowerPoint did not like that word and underlined it, so I'm not sure it's a word. But he was one who took various pieces of the Reformation theology and molded them together into a complete system. And his system is what is known as TULIP, T-U-L-I-P, summarizes the 5 points of Calvinism. I don't know why it's wanting to do this, but let me go back here. And so the 5 points of Calvinism are, 1, total depravity, which we're going to talk about this evening. 2, unconditional election. U stands for unconditional election, or the idea that the elect are predestination it is called. That from the beginning of time, God had a plan for the salvation of certain ones and the damnation of others. And that God in his sovereignty chose some to be saved and some to be lost. Really behind all of Calvinism is the idea of the sovereignty of God. We don't have time to talk about that this evening, but really that's the foundation behind it, is that God is sovereign, God is the ruler, God knows best, God knows. If you ever say that, well, that's not fair, it's not fair for God to choose who's going to be saved and who's going to be lost, they will say, well, God in his wisdom, God in his power, God in his knowledge, he knows what you would have chosen, so he predetermined what was going to happen. So unconditional election, limited atonement. The L is limited atonement, meaning Jesus didn't die for everyone. He died just for the elect. Irresistible grace, that God gives grace, and when he gives grace, you cannot resist. This fits in with the concept, with their idea of the working of the Holy Spirit. All this ties together in so many ways with modern denominational thinking. You hear people talking about the Spirit and the working of the Spirit, and that you have to wait for the Spirit to come on you, and the Spirit leads you and guides you, and all that is connected back to Calvinism. And so they say you're totally depraved, you were born in sin, and the only way that you can overcome that, the fact that you're in depravity, and we're going to talk more about that, and so you'll understand maybe that a little bit more, is for God to irresistibly draw you. It's through the Spirit of God that God draws you to him, and apart from the drawing of the Spirit, you cannot be saved. And then the P is the perseverance of the saints, more commonly called once saved, always saved. And so, I don't know why this is doing this, but we'll bear with it. And so, what is total depravity? total depravity, and this is from a website called Got Questions, and it is a denominational website, and it is a Calvinistic website. I don't know if it's Baptist or what, but some kind of evangelical Baptist or evangelical of some kind, which is usually at some level, at some extent, Calvinistic in their nature. And so God Questions says it is called total inability. It's called total depravity, or the author of this website says it's also referred to as total inability, or righteous incapability, or radical corruption, or even moral inability. These are all words or terms that have been used by some of their people to describe the idea of total depravity. He says, while often misunderstood, the doctrine of total depravity is an acknowledgement that the Bible teaches that as a result of the fall of man from the original sin in Genesis chapter 3, the first sin, it is an acknowledgement that the Bible teaches that as a result of the fall of man, every part of man, his mind, his will, emotions, and flesh have been corrupted by sin. One thing I want you to notice as we read through and think about this idea of depravity. Depravity and original sin, technically those two terms are often used interchangeably. We talk about original sin being the first sin, but there are some who believe that original sin in some way was passed down to us, don't believe fully in this idea of total depravity. So the two are not always equal in their understanding. Original sin has to do with that first original sin. But total depravity is more than just the fact that sin has been passed down. It's more than just the fact that we are guilty. Yes, that's a part of it. It's a part of it is that because of Adam's first sin, then everyone who has ever been born since then is guilty of Adam's sin. But it's more than just being guilty of the sin. It is this idea of being depraved, of being so corrupted in mind and will and emotions and flesh that we are. When you are born, you are totally, you can do no good. In other words, I keep on reading, sin affects all area of our being, including who we are and what we do. It penetrates to the very core of our being so that everything is tainted by sin. And all our righteous acts are like filthy rags before a holy God, Isaiah 64. The believers in a strict concept of this depravity of sin teach that what you are born guilty of Adam's sin, that's handed down to you, but it's more than just the guilt of the sin. It's that you are totally corrupt. Nothing you do is good. Even things that might be good by someone else is not good for you to do it because of the fact that you do it for the wrong motives and you do it with the wrong heart. Your heart is corrupt and nothing you can do is good. Your whole nature has been corrupted. And so he says it acknowledges that the Bible teaches that we sin because we are sinners by nature. Total depravity refers to the nature of fallen persons, not just their deeds. It's their whole nature is corrupted. The word total refers to the total person, that every aspect of the person, mind, will, emotions, body, is corrupted by sin. And to the total human race, that every person since Adam and Eve, except for Jesus Christ, has been born with a nature that is alienated from God and in rebellion against God. Also, depravity must be viewed in relation to God, not by comparing men with men. With reference to God, total depravity means that no one is able in and of himself to do anything to choose God. The Calvinist says, the strict Calvinist and those who believe in inherited total depravity, because you are born with a depraved nature, you can do no good. You cannot do anything. If you want to go to church, if you want to be a Christian, if you want to, you cannot do anything to please God. Until the Spirit works upon your heart and you are born again. It takes that other part of the tulip, the irresistible grace, the irresistible working of the Spirit. But until God works on your heart, you can do nothing to please Him. You are totally and completely corrupted. He is not able in and of himself to do anything to choose God, to seek God, to please God, to love God, to glorify God, or to merit his salvation. Left to himself, every person will seek the things of self and sin. We are unable to seek God. We are as unable to seek God as a corpse can choose to get up and walk. Now, I didn't make that up. I didn't say that. That's the Calvinist who says that. That's the believer in this system who says this. You can do nothing. You're corrupt. Your heart and your mind are totally corrupted. He goes on, the Westminster Confession states it clearly. Speaking of Adam and Eve, it says, by this sin they fell from their original righteousness and communion with God, and so became dead in sin and wholly defiled in all the parts of faculty of soul and body. They being the root of all mankind, the guilt of this sin was imputed, and the same death in sin and corrupt nature conveyed to all their posterity, descending from them by ordinary generation. In other words, this same corrupt, their nature was corrupted by that sin. Not only did they sin, but their nature was corrupted. They could do no good. And that same nature would be handed down by ordinary generation, by ordinary birth, to every generation to follow. From this original corruption, whereby we are utterly indisposed, disabled, and made opposite to all good, and wholly inclined to all evil, do proceed all actual transgressions. Any actual sins that you commit come as a result of that corrupted nature, which you have by birth, which you can do nothing about, until the Spirit of God works upon your heart to change you. So, summary, depravity to the Calvinist refers to one's nature, not their deeds. You're not depraved because you're a sinner. You're a sinner because you're depraved. You're depraved and you can do nothing about it. You're born that way and you can do nothing about it. Two, total means, Calvinist teaches that every aspect of our nature has been corrupted. Total corruption of mind, will, emotions, and body. Thirdly of all, we cannot do God's will. You cannot choose to do God's will. You cannot choose to do anything good or correct until God by His Spirit works upon your heart. You can do no good whatsoever. That is their teaching. Calvinism says that our depraved nature has been imputed to everyone automatically from birth, from physical birth. And fifthly of all, from our corrupted nature and inborn inclinations come the actual transgressions in which we have. Another summary. Born in sin, but much more. Remember what I said. Original sin, yes, but depravity, according to the Calvinist. And it has come down in lesser and greater degrees in many, many denominational churches around us in this world. I would dare say most denominational churches in America today hold to some form of Calvinism. Almost everyone is Calvinistic in the, quote, Protestant religious world. Born in sin, but much more. We are depraved in our nature. We inherit by birth total, complete, and entire depravity, corruption of the full nature. Totally unable to do what is good. Now notice some other quotes, and I'll go through these quickly. But again, just the quotes to show this is embedded in the theology of people around us. Lutheran theology. The church describes a person's sinful nature as original or inherited sin. Its origin can be traced back to our first parents. It is an inheritance which is passed from one generation to another. As an old couplet puts it, in Adam's fall, we sinned all. For practical purposes, Adam acted as mankind's representative when he sinned. The word sin does not describe a wrong word, feeling, or action. It describes a person's original state. Notice that. The word sin does not describe a wrong word or action. It describes an original state of separation from God, being dead through sins. People are by nature sinful. They do not acquire sinfulness after they are born. They are born sinners. Sinners beget sinners as naturally as apple trees bear apples, because all creatures clothed with flesh, human flesh, are sinners. All creatures clothed with human flesh are sinners. Flesh and sinfulness often mean the same thing in the New Testament. If you doubt your sinfulness, Luther said, just pinch yourself and notice what you are holding between your fingers. What are you holding between your fingers when you pinch yourself? Flesh. And he equated flesh with sin. You're born in sin. You're depraved, and you're born in sin. And the flesh is equal to sin. What's the proof? Well, let's notice some passages that are used by the advocates of inherited total depravity. And they often point, it's interesting as you read through the literature, they often point to many passages which emphasize the sinfulness of man. And of course, what we would point out back to them is that just pointing out to me passages that talk about the sinfulness of man don't make the argument that we're inherently sinful, or that we have to sin, or that we have a corrupted nature. Those are two different things. But they use many, many passages. And so as I went through and looked at different passages and different articles referencing those passages, I could give them to you by the dozens, because there were dozens of passages that they would use, but really don't prove anything at all. It just proves that man is sinful. Here are some of them. Psalm 14, verse 1. This is one that they use. The fool has said in his heart, there is no God. They are corrupted. They have committed abominable deeds. There is no one who does good. Well, that's true. That's true. We'll notice a little bit later in Romans chapter 3, Paul strings together a bunch of these passages to talk about the fact that all have sinned and fall short of the glory of God. Yes, we've all sinned. And the fool has said there is no God. And all mankind have corrupted themselves and sinned before God. But that didn't mean that they were born that way. This passage doesn't say they were born that way. It doesn't prove they were born that way. It doesn't prove they have a corrupted nature. And so once again, they use a passage about the sinfulness of man and assume it's what they're teaching when it's not what they're teaching at all. There's a number of others. Genesis chapter 6, verse 5, they often use, when the Lord saw the wickedness of man was great upon the earth, and every intent of the thoughts of his heart was evil continually. Had the world become corrupted? Absolutely. In the days before Noah, it became so corrupted that the Lord says here that every intent of the thoughts of the heart of mankind was evil constantly. But were they born that way? Were they born so corrupt they couldn't think of good things and righteous things? No, the passage doesn't say that. Yes, they became corrupt, and some civilizations have become so corrupt that's all people think about is evil. I went to high school with kids like that. Did you ever go to high school or college or know people in the world whose thoughts were so evil you couldn't say anything? They'd twist it to make it dirty in some way. Were they born that way? Were they corrupted from youth that way? It's because they had been around people and hanging around people who thought that way and teased that way, and they turned everything into smut, into dirt. But it was because they couldn't help it. It's because of practice and habit and constantly thinking on things that are evil that their minds have become evil. And so once again, the passage does not say what they want it to say. Jeremiah 17:9 is another one they often throw out there. The heart is more deceitful than all else and is desperately sick. Yeah, Jeremiah said that, and he was talking about sinners of his day and time who had become so corrupted that they were referred to as desperately sick. The nation had turned against God. And the nation had turned to idols, and the nation was doing abominable things, and they were desperately sick. That's just a statement of fact. But it doesn't say they were born that way, etc. Romans 3, as we said a moment ago, Paul strings together a number of quotes from the Old Testament. Here's a few of them. There is none righteous, no, not one. There is none that understands. There is none that seeks after God. There is none that does good, not even one. Their throat is an open grave. Their tongues, they keep deceiving. With their tongues, they keep deceiving. Their feet are swift to shed blood. There is no fear of God before their eyes. Once again, all true statements, all taken from the Old Testament, used by the Apostle Paul, quoting from the Old Testament to emphasize the fact that all have sinned. As he says in verse 23, and fallen short of the glory of God. Not a single one of these verses used to prove or could prove that men were born that way or just couldn't help themselves and were totally corrupt in their nature, within their basic nature. Mark 7, 20 to 23, another passage which they use. He was saying, that which proceeds out of the man is that is what defiles the man. And from within, out of the heart of man, proceeds evil thoughts, fornications, thefts, murders, adulteries, deeds of coveting and wickedness, as well as deceit, sensuality, envy, slander, pride, and foolishness. All these evil things proceed from within and defile the man. Absolutely. Absolutely true. They defile the man. Sin comes from within. It's because in my heart, just as I was talking about my old high school buddies, their hearts had become corrupted. All they thought about was evil things, just like the people in the days of Noah. But were they born that way? No. Could they help themselves? Yes. Did they help themselves? Usually not. But once again, the passage has nothing to do with inherited total depravity. Unbelievers in Ephesians chapter 4 are likened to darkened in their understanding, excluded from the life of God because of ignorance that is in them. Once again, the passage says nothing. It's a passage that's used by them to try to, quote, prove inherited total depravity, but it doesn't have anything to say about inherited total depravity. Romans 8, the same way, because the mind of the flesh is hostile towards God, for it does not subject itself to the law of God, for it is not even able to do so, and those who are of the flesh cannot please God. That's exactly right. They would use it to say, when you're in the flesh, when you're depraved, you cannot please God, you cannot do anything to please God. Well, it's true. What Paul is talking about here is a saying that when we're in the flesh, when we walk in the flesh, when we live in the flesh, when we do and live by the flesh and by the mind, we cannot please God. That is absolutely true. That's a spiritual truth. But it doesn't say we were born that way or that we can't be different. We can have the mind of the Spirit. He appeals for us here to have the mind of the Spirit. So once again, it doesn't say what they wanted to say. So the answer is that we do not deny that man is sinful, that man is disobedient, that man is corrupt. Passages like these could be multiplied on this point, but these passages do not say that we were born that way. In fact, often they say just the opposite. We referred in the very beginning to a passage in Psalm chapter 14, and verse 3 of that same context says, they have all turned aside. Together they have become corrupt. That's what the writer of Psalm says. They become corrupt. It didn't say they were born corrupt, but they have become corrupt. So once again, often the passages do not say. But there's a couple in particular that I want to look at just a little bit more closely because of the fact that they might give us, at least on the surface, they might give us a little bit more problem. These others are easy to answer in the sense that they just don't say what they say they say. But there's a passage here that is often used, and it is in Ephesians chapter 2, the first few verses, where it says that ye were by nature children of wrath, even as the rest. And so if you want to open your Bibles up there to Ephesians chapter 2 and notice that verse, here in Ephesians 2, the Apostle Paul is talking about the life that we can have in Jesus. And that in their former lives, they were dead in their trespasses and dead in their sins. And so in verse 1, you did he make alive when you were dead through your trespasses and sins, wherein you once walked, according to the course of this world, according to the spirit of the prince of the power of the air, the spirit that now works in the sons of disobedience, among whom we also all once lived in the lust of our flesh, doing the desires of the flesh and of the mind, and were by nature children of wrath, even as the rest. And so Paul says, you once walked in these things, you once lived in these ways, you once lived in the lusts of your flesh, doing the desires of all these things, and yet the Calvinist will say, well, here it is. It says, you were by nature children of wrath. And so the advocates of this position maintain that our inherited nature is sinful. And as we have pointed out, certainly the passage shows what a sinful condition these individuals were in. But the passage also shows us how that they arrived at this condition. It says in verse 1 and 5 that they were dead through their trespasses. Now notice their position. This is critically important. Their position is that you do not arrive. Remember those quotes I gave to you? In those quotes they said that you're not depraved because you sin. You sin because you're depraved. But this passage teaches that we're dead, not because we're born that way. We're not dead because we're depraved. That's the way it should say if their theory were true. but we're dead through trespasses. We're dead through sin. They walked in these things. They lived in these things. They were indulging in these things. They were following after these things. And then he says, you were by nature children of wrath. And again, the second point about this is that this word nature does not mean what they want it to mean. They want it to mean that you were born that way. But the word nature here, according to Thayer, means a mode of feeling and acting which by long habit has become nature or become natural to us. We would say second nature. That's what the word means. We say like riding a bike or by walking or doing things like that, muscle memory. And we say you get on a bike and you hadn't ridden a bike. It's been years since I rode a bike. And then you get on a bike and you can ride it. Why can you do that? Because it's like, it's muscle memory. It's like second nature to you. You did it so often, you can do it again. You don't have to think about it. You get up and you walk. You leave here. Now, if you've got a problem, maybe walking's not so easy for you. But most of us are able to get up and walk, and we don't think about it. We don't think about putting one foot in front of the other. But when a child is a toddler and they're just learning, they have to learn how to do that. Their muscles have to learn how to do that. But we understand this idea of second nature, of just doing something by habit. We do it so often, it becomes natural to us. And that's what this word means. A mode of feeling or acting by long habit has become nature. He says, ye are by nature children of wrath. It doesn't mean they were born that way, but they had lived so long. It's like my old buddies in high school. They had thought in an ugly way so long that anything anybody said, they would think a dirty thing about it. They had trained their minds in that direction. And so people, sin becomes natural to them. They don't even have to think about it. It just becomes a part of their nature. And that's what the Apostle Paul is saying here. Yes, the Ephesian Christians had formerly been sinful, wretched individuals. But it was not due to their inherited sinful nature, but a skill that they had learned and perfected. And so they were by nature, by habit, children deserving of wrath. Well, let's go to that last passage. David says, "And sin did my mother conceive me." What is this talking about? This, of course, is another of their favorites, and where we began the lesson and picked up last Wednesday evening. Psalm 51:5, "Behold, I was brought forth in iniquity, and in sin did my mother conceive me." Another that goes along with it is Psalm 58, verse 3, that they often use. "The wicked are estranged from the womb. Those who speak lies go astray from birth." And so from the womb, and they speak lies from birth. We'll get back to that. A writer says, I think this is Wayne Jackson, said, "This verse, however, which is said in highly figurative Hebrew poetry, merely refers to the fact that David was born into a sinful environment." It's not saying that David was born guilty of Adam's sin or with a corrupted nature. David is saying that he was born into a sinful environment. Some believe that the phrase, "I was born in iniquity and in sin did my mother conceive me," refers to the mother's sin. I don't think that's what David is saying. I don't think David is dumping on his mother. I don't think David is blaming his mother. I don't think he's referring to his mother's sin. In the context, to me, that wouldn't make any sense for David to be confessing his sins and then in verse 5 to say, "In sin did my mother conceive me." My mother was sinful when I was born. That doesn't seem to me to fit the context. But some brethren have thought that that's what he's saying. I think David is talking about the sinful environment which he was born into. We are all conceived in and brought forth, our quote goes on to say, brought forth into a sinful world. But we do not actually sin until we arrive at an age of spiritual responsibility. David, by use of dramatic language, affirms that sin had characterized his whole life, relatively speaking. David is saying, "I was brought forth into a sinful world, and I've been a sinner ever since." David is not blaming the world. Please understand that. David here is freely confessing his sin. David, as you read this psalm, is clearly saying, against thee, thee only have I sinned. I've done wrong. I can blame no one else. But he's acknowledging or stating the fact that his whole life, he is just saying his whole life has been characterized by sin. Not in a way to blame anyone else, but just to state the fact, I've messed up, Father, I've messed up my whole life. I think that's what David is talking about. In a similar poetic section, for example, the writer goes on to say, Wayne Jackson, yes. Job, in denying that he had neglected his benevolent responsibilities, affirmed that he had cared for the orphan and widow from his mother's womb. Job 31. We'll notice the exact quote on that in just a moment. Surely no one contends that on day one of his existence that he was out ministering to the needy. In fact, the Hebrew parallelism of this verse clearly indicates that the word womb is used in the sense of youth. And so the writer makes the argument, David says, and sin did my mother conceive me. But Job says he cared for the widow and orphan from his mother's womb. Did Job literally, from the day he was born, care for the widow and the orphan? Well, no one understands that way. Obviously not. But it's using Hebrew poetic language to say, from an early time in my life, I've tried to do good. That's all Job was saying. I've done good to others for as long as I can remember. Here's the passage in Job 31. If I have withheld the poor from their desire, if I have caused the eyes of the widow to fail, or have eaten my morsel alone, and the fatherless hath not eaten thereof, nay, from my youth he grew up with me as with a father, and her have I guided from my mother's womb. So Job says, from my mother's womb I did these things. Literally? No, not literally. But using the same kind of poetic language. Another verse we could use is Acts chapter 2 in the New Testament, where the apostles were speaking in tongues on that occasion on the day of Pentecost. And the people on that occasion, when they heard the apostles speak, said, and how hear we every man in our own language wherein we were born? Are you born speaking a language? No. Not on the day you're born, but you're born surrounded in a culture where language is spoken. If you're born in China, you're born speaking Chinese, but you're not born speaking anything. You learn it because of the people around you. If you're born in America, you speak English or Spanish, if that's what your family is speaking. And if you live in Italy, you're going to speak Italian. Why? Because that's the environment in which you were born into. But they said, we hear every man in the language wherein we were born. What are they talking about? Well, obviously, it's figurative language to refer to the fact that individuals are born into a situation where they're surrounded by a language and that's what they learn. And we talk that way. And we use figures of speech in this way. And so Job was not saying that he helped the widow from the day he was born. Literally. And David was not saying he was a sinner from the day that he was born. To understand Bible passages, sometimes we have to compare other Bible passages. In conclusion, sin is disobedience, rebellion, neglect, transgression. Sin is something you do. If we had more time, or maybe another night, we'll talk more about this. There's more to be said. And one thing to be said and talked more about is this idea of sin. Sin is something you do. The Bible never teaches that sin is something you inherit. Sin is an action that you do. It's a disobedience. It's a rebellion. It's a neglect. It's something you perform. It's an act that you do, either in action or in thought or in words and speech. So we can sin in various ways, but it's always something that we do or something that we fail to do, disobeying by failing to do what God wants us to do. We're guilty because of our own actions, not because you inherit someone else's guilt. From beginning to end, Bible teaches personal responsibility. You're responsible for your own sin. And so Ezekiel chapter 20, 18 verse 20, the soul that sinneth, it shall die. And this knocks it in the head. All these other principles knock it in the head too. But Ezekiel 18:20 says, the soul that sins, it shall die. The Son shall not bear the iniquity of the Father, and the Father shall not bear the iniquity of the Son. The righteousness of the righteous will be upon him, and the wickedness of the wicked will be upon him. You're not responsible for what your father did. And you can't ride your mother and father's coattails into heaven either. Their righteousness will not be imputed to you if you do not do what is right before God and obey the gospel of the Son of God. There's good news and bad news tonight. The good news is you're not born in sin. The bad news is you're still a sinner. You've disobeyed God. All have sinned and fallen short of the glory of God, Romans 3, verse 23. And so if you're a sinner tonight that has never obeyed the gospel, if you're a sinner that has not come to Jesus Christ, you can't blame anyone else. You must respond to God's gospel yourself. And so if there is anyone that needs to respond in any way tonight, whether the primary obedience in baptism or to confess wrongs that you've committed that need to be confessed publicly and desire the prayers of your brothers and sisters here, whatever that need may be, will you let that be known as we stand and sing?